My name is Blanche, and I am a member of a worldwide fellowship called Al-Anon High.
Amen.
I have been in reluctant recovery since July 7th, 1964, but I have been addicted to mood-changing, mind-altering men ever since I can remember. Little identification there, all right. 35 years makes me a survivor, not a savior, and I have to remind myself of that on a regular basis. I need to remember at all times that I'm one person away from an obsession. I really didn't want to talk, not that I don't love you dearly and not that I don't like to talk, but I figure everyone in Texas has heard every thought I have ever had. And I said that to Anna last year when she asked me if I would talk this year. Buddy Ross heard me say that, and he pointed out that there might be a little ego involved in that. He said, not only is it not true that everyone has heard you talk, but they don't remember every syllable you utter either. When Anna said she wanted to have some, she was kind enough not to say old-timers, some of the people who had been around in the start of this convention, then of course I wanted to do it. Thank you for letting me come. It's always an honor to share my program anywhere. When people introduce me who have been around such a long time, I'm always glad, who've known me such a long time, I'm always glad they don't tell you everything they know, because those of us who've been around a while, I have been trying for an awfully long time now. I remember when and where I made the decision. To be as honest and as open as I know how to be with you, perhaps you don't know, but anyone standing on a podium and talking into a microphone is pretty emotionally naked. We are very vulnerable. You aren't taking any risks at all. And we are risking being rejected and being misunderstood and, oh my word, being misquoted. And so that's what I want. And you told me I could ask for what I wanted. See, it would be easier for me to tell you what I think than how I feel, and easier for me to just lecture you on the program. But I didn't come here to lecture. I came here to share. You told me years ago that that which does not come from the heart does not reach the heart. And I very much want to reach your hearts tonight, so I will talk to you from mine. After all, I came here to participate in your weekend, you know, not to perform. Those of you who have heard me, and that seems to be most of you, or you've heard tapes, I'd appreciate it if you don't mouth it along with me while I'm talking. That distracts me, it really does. I don't know how to tell my story twice a month for 35 years and vary it every time. It's pretty much the same. I can't go out and do it over again, just so I'll have something different to tell you. I do use notes a little bit, like having the music in front of you. Some people have a real problem with that. If you do, then I suggest you call your sponsor and discuss acceptance. And if you heard me without them, you'd be very glad I used them. I have heard speakers say, God can just tell me what to say. Well, yes, but he isn't limited to doing that the minute I step onto the podium. I've known for a year that I was coming, and he's had plenty of time to tell me what to say. And so I jotted things down as I thought of them and that I want to share with you. I would rather you leave here thinking what a marvelous program than what a marvelous speaker. And she said, let's just always say a little silent prayer for the person that needs the help. I've thought of that a lot lately because if it were conceivable for me to have some sort of siren I could sound every time I'm going to talk about Al-Anon, I would. And then I would tell you, help is on the way. I wish we could do it dramatically enough that everybody would get that message and would understand it. I certainly didn't for a long time. I came into Al-Anon kicking and screaming and clutching my halo and wrapping my robes of righteousness about me, my heels dug in. I was complaining to everyone who would listen, and a lot of people who didn't care, that I was fine, thank you. If we didn't have drinking at our house, we would have no problems. I can't say it with a straight face now, but I believed it then. And I, God forgive me, and he has, but he keeps sending me people like that too. So I told him I got the message, you know, he can ease up on that. They forgave me when my behavior was well nigh unforgivable. And that's how I learned about Al-Anon principles. And I learned what we are not before I learned what we are. I learned that Al-Anon is not a ladies' auxiliary. And I'll explain this a little because I still run across it, not just in Texas, but everywhere I go. There are well-meaning members of AA, and I think they just haven't thought it through. Well, anyway, back to what it is not. We are not cookie bakers and coffee makers, and above all, we are not AA groupies. Al-Anon has never claimed to be a therapeutic tool for the treatment of alcoholism. That isn't our business. My mother was dying. She was in Florida. I was in Texas. I got to see her 4 times the last 6 months of her life. I know it isn't fashionable to love your family, so sue me. I adored this woman. You would have too. Everyone else did too. And on the last visit, I knew it would be my last one. I was crying so hard, I stepped out into the hall so she wouldn't have to watch me cry. And a woman in the room across the hall, whom I've never seen before or since, beckoned me into her room. And when I stepped in, she said, "Your mother's going to be all right." And I said, "Oh, you don't understand. Her illness is terminal." And this woman said, "I didn't say she's going to get well. I said she's going to be all right." And if you had, I would have said, "You don't understand. I have a barely sober husband." And you would have said, "Oh, we didn't promise you a sober husband. We said you're going to be all right." Or I would have said, "I have a very fragile marriage." And you would have said, "We didn't promise you a marriage. We said you're going to be all right." Now, sketching the background is important, and it has its place. But that's merely the foundation of the talk. The best Al-Anon talk, the one that helps the most people to the highest degree, is the one that brings out just how the program works and just how the speaker follows it. A good Al-Anon talk may be divided into 3 parts. How sick I was, how well I am, what helped me to get well. Of these 3, the emphasis should be on what helped me to get well. I've always agreed with Father Martin, who says if he's sitting out there and you're up here, he says, "You're playing with my life. Don't tell me how sick you were without telling me how well you are." So I hope I can spend the majority of the minutes I have with you tonight sharing with you the things that have helped me to get well. But sketching the background is important. I was born on my grandmother's farm in northeast Florida, almost to the Georgia border, near a town called Lake City on Christmas Day, and I no longer say the year of our Lord, which one. I reached the age where I not only lie about how old I am, but I forget what I said that it was. It's only a matter of time till I can hide my own Easter eggs. But I'm somewhere between Blue Lagoon and Golden Pond, all right? My family has been in Florida for 7 generations. The 7th generation is almost 3 years old, and he's darling. But I'm trying to tell you, we were not tourists. And tourist was a bad word. Anytime I behaved in a manner my mother considered inappropriate, she would say, "Don't act like a tourist." I'm a very good tourist when I go places. I know how to behave. Unfortunately, he was violent. I was never, thank God, sexually abused, but I was a very badly battered child. It was so long before I could say that into a microphone. And you know, it needs saying. It's not that uncommon in alcoholic homes. And let me say quickly, it isn't always the alcoholic who does the battering. but violence is not that uncommon anyway. Let me say, by the way, that poverty has nothing to recommend it. It does not ennoble the human spirit. It's a debasing and a degrading way to live. I hope you will fight it every way you can, with your checkbook and your ballot and any other way that you can fight it. I have to tell you that much to say, neighborhood children were not allowed to play with me. I know now their parents were understandably apprehensive about what was going on at my house. But when you're 3 and 4 and 5 and 6 years old, you don't know that. I felt rejection and rage. And I'm sorry to have to tell you, a desire to get back at them. We all went to the same neighborhood school, and I could beat the socks off all of them. And I did, and I relished every minute of it. Now, that wasn't a good motivation, but it had a happy byproduct. I fell in love with learning, and I've never fallen out of love with it. Even today, you know, the most exciting thing I know is a new idea, and the older you get, the fewer of them you find. I was a pre-Al-Anon, a candidate for Al-Anon even then. I managed to hide from my mother the fact that I was being beaten. But I reached an age where I could not hide the blood and the bruises any longer, and when she found out, she was horrified and devastated and divorced my father. A couple of years later, she remarried a man that, as it happened, didn't drink at all. We were never close, he and I, but he loved my mother, and that's all I asked of him. And he was a good man, and I have been grateful for him in our lives. They had two little boys. College was considered a luxury, and there weren't any luxuries, only necessities. And when I talked to my mother about it, she said, I told her I wanted to go to college in Texas. I said, I want to go to Baylor University, and that's where it happens to be. And she said, well, fine, a couple of things. She said, you know, you'll have to pay for it yourself. Well, yes. If I had another hour to talk to you, I would tell you the series of miracles that enabled me to pay for it and to graduate. And then she said, if you go to college in Texas, make up your mind that you'll spend the rest of your life out there, because she said, you'll end up marrying a Texan and they don't transplant, she told me. I told her I was going to do no such thing, but I did, and they don't, and I have, and so what can I tell you? When I'm talking in faraway places, British Columbia, you know, Toronto, Wyoming, I have to explain that Texas is a state of mind. Now, I don't have to tell you that, of course, but Texans have never forgotten that they were a nation, and this is the kind of pride that they feel. My father-in-law said he brought up his children never to ask a man where he was from, because he said, if he's from Texas, he'll tell you, and if he's not, it's not nice to embarrass him. I know. It seems like a bit much. I always tell people that we do it in fun. I don't think they believe me, but even bumper stickers, you know, like on Earth as it is in Texas. And you remember that until a few years ago, we had a governor and a lieutenant governor who, by their own declaration, were recovering alcoholics. My husband said that made everyone in the state of Texas eligible for Al-Anon. We were all being influenced by an alcoholic. But I want you to know I tried not to. I didn't date anyone who drank. It wasn't hard at Baylor. You know, it's a Baptist convent. If you drank, you were sent home. Just, you know, no questions asked, no anything. You just went home. And so when I married Charles, my college sweetheart, the drinking is only a symptom of alcoholism. You said it's as if he had had tuberculosis, but he hadn't yet started hemorrhaging. That symptom had not yet manifested itself. But just the fact that he didn't drink didn't mean I escaped marrying an alcoholic. We had matching illnesses. We nourished these neuroses in each other for a very long time. And you said sick people marry sick people. and they rear sick children, and I haven't found any exceptions to those. I hope you won't let anyone tell you anything different. We lived in Corpus Christi a year in San Antonio for 4 years. Our children were born there. And then we moved out to West Texas, to Odessa, my husband's hometown. If you have been to West Texas, you know the landscape is somewhat like that of the moon. My mother thought I had gone to the end of the world. She used to call it Odessolate. But not where anyone could hear her, of course. I never learned to like the sandstorms or the barrenness, but I love those people. I have a theory, totally unsubstantiated, as all my theories are, that people who live in inhospitable, unforgiving climates don't know there's anything they can't do, so they do it. I have seen people like that in North and South Dakota, in Montana and Wyoming, and the prairie provinces of Canada. When I talk there, I can look at those faces, and I can see them crossing the plains in a covered wagon, you know, which I don't think I would have done. But I'm not much of a pioneer. I think West Texas people are a breed apart, and I'm so grateful that's where, little applause here. By the way, this year I will have been 18 years in each assembly. Did you ever play Guess What I'm Mad About? Charles used to say I could ask him a question, answer it myself, and go away mad. Not true. I did a great many wrong things during the drinking years, and I kept on doing them. I had a cleaning woman. Oh, I wish I still had her. She was wonderful. And during football season, when she ironed, she watched football. Now, here again, when I'm talking somewhere else, thousands and thousands of miles away, and I get to this part of my story, I say, but then all Texans are football fans, and they look at me politely and nod, and I think, you don't understand. I try to tell them it's second only to oxygen, you know. And anyway, she would watch football, and she never caught on to instant replay. And she would say to me, maybe this time he'll catch it. And I thought, that's what I've been doing. I did the same things over and over, because he'll stop drinking if I do this. And he didn't. It was as if it were instant replay over and over. I protected him. I lied for him. I played let's pretend as diligently as he drank. And he was almost literally loved to death, and that can happen. I was as obsessed with him as he was compelled to drink. Women in the Deep South were given a specific and definite kind of upbringing. We were expected to flutter our eyelashes and flash our dimples and swish our skirts, but it was understood that we were made of steel and we could cope with anything. Remember Scarlett O'Hara in the sweet potato field? I'll never be hungry again. That kind of coping. And I was a steel magnolia long before there was a play and a movie by that name. I did a few things right during those years. I never called Charles a drunk. I never thought of him that way. I was married to a very fine man who drank too much. At some level, I didn't know he was sick, but I knew he wouldn't be this way if he could help it. I did know that. You have to remember that in early 60s, alcoholism was a stigma. It wasn't trendy. It wasn't chic to be alcoholic. There were not celebrities, you know, going through the Betty Ford Center and shouting to the world that they were in 12-step programs, breaking every tradition we have. But even so, it just wasn't happening. And nobody knew the whole family was sick, too. I talked to our family doctor a lot about the problems. And he would say the things you would have said if I had known you then. He said, you have to do what is necessary for your sanity and your serenity regardless. And he knew just which button to push. He said, your children need one stable parent. Well, need is the operative word. If you need me, I'm still putty in your hands. I try, but that's still a button you can push with me. He thought I should go back to teaching school. I had taught before my children were born. But in those decades, a good mother did not work outside her home. Anyway, a little more about that later. When I left West Texas, by the way, I hated leaving Permian High School more than anything or anybody there. I cried harder over that. It was not one long honeymoon. There were days when I wished for retroactive birth control, but not usually. Usually I was fine. We didn't know what was wrong with Charles. You see, he wasn't violent. He didn't drink the way my father had, and I didn't think alcoholism. And he wasn't in hospitals or jails because he drank at home. But we knew something was badly wrong, and he kept trying to find an answer. I respected him then, and I still do, for trying to find an answer. And she told me her name, which I recognized, and she said, "Your husband is alcoholic. This is a family illness. I need to talk to you, too." And I said, "You're out of your mind," and hung up. Now, that was not Deep South upbringing. I have been taught that if you have trouble liking someone, you can be kind but cool, and I wasn't either of those words in any of their meanings. Before I could leave the room, the phone rang again, and when I picked it up before I could say hello, she said, "Don't hang up." She said, "I know what you've been through." Well, she couldn't know. I hadn't told anybody. But I stood there with the phone in my hand, and I thought all the tears had long since been shed. And I cried and I cried and I cried. That was your first gift to me, long before I got to a meeting. I cry anytime I please now. Charles used to say I could cry reading a telephone directory or a menu. No, but supermarket openings are touching, don't you? I cry at television commercials. You know, the Folgers coffee one when the soldier comes home. You know, yes. I cry at the Olympic Games. Someone wins a gold medal and they play his national anthem and he cries and I cry. I'm just a basket case, and that's okay. I had a lot of crying to catch up on. For 6 months, I went with Charles only to open meetings, and if anyone had the questionable judgment to invite me to Al-Anon, I was kind but cool. And I explained, as I told you, that I hadn't done the drinking and I was fine, thank you. He says, "When I talk about this, I must always tell you it was not a slip. It was a carefully planned drunk." I know now that I wasn't surprised. I didn't expect him to stop drinking. Don't you know that attitude helped him a lot? But see, on the way home, he said to me, I'm due to get a 6 month chip next week, and I've got to tell my group about this. Do you give mementos of sobriety in your groups or your AA groups?" We gave poker chip cue rings. And I was so appallingly ignorant, and I said, "I won't tell anybody." And he explained to me that wasn't quite the name of the game. That's what got me to go back and take another look. I had wanted to be the one to get him sober. You see, then he would have owed it all to the love of a good woman, and he would have been grateful to me the rest of his life. And you may be sure I would have seen to it that he was. And that's when I began to realize that God doesn't necessarily use me where I tell him to. Sometimes I get myself out of the way enough that he can use me, but I don't get to call the shots on when and where. And I told you I went in condescending and patronizing, and God has forgiven me for that. We have a pamphlet entitled Living with Sobriety, and it says that while sobriety can be a welcome miracle, it will not guarantee happiness. We had a very difficult and stormy sobriety. The first 2 years were worse than anything we ever had drinking. Charles was stark raving sober, very much aware of all of my defects of character. He was no longer held back by guilt from mentioning them loudly and clearly and frequently. And I was trying so hard to hang on to this overlay of pretense. We are a normal family, you know. There's nothing wrong with us. I married into a fine old family that had money and prestige. There was nobody not allowed to play with me anymore. And I thought if I went down to that building with those people, I would lose all of that. Of course, I got to you in bad shape. We all do. I was emotionally frozen. I didn't think this through during the years he was drinking, but I can tell in hindsight it was like this. And you can't stand pain like that. And so what I thought I would do, I guess, was, it's as if I thought feelings had valves or faucets, and I would turn off the one marked resentment. I would turn off the one marked anger, the one marked self-pity. And what I didn't know until I got to you was that there is one valve, and it's marked feelings. And when I turned them off, I was really emotionally frozen when I got to you. And you loved me until I could love myself. And it's painful when something that has been frozen is thawing. We come in with defenses built. Oh, it's as if we were encased in armor. And I had a sword. You weren't going to hurt me, by golly. And I had, and after I wasn't so hostile, I put down the sword. And when I decided you were safe people, you know, I could put down the shield. And I see people do that now too. I no longer batter at people's defenses. I used to do that. Let me in. I want to be your friend. Let me tell you about this way of life. You know, I think that's kind of an emotional rape. I don't do that. When they no longer need the defenses, they will let them go. I just hate the waiting. So I began to hear the program, and not all at once and not from just one person. I've already told you it wasn't trendy back then. It wasn't the end thing to be alcoholic. There were not treatment centers on every corner. There weren't announcements every 30 minutes on television. And nobody knew the family was sick too. Those little ones were a whole new world to me. I had never worked with little children. I had been visiting with a first grader, and we were walking back to his room. Well, he was bouncing, you know, and I was holding his hand. He said, "My teacher's not here today." I said, I noticed. He said, "She's sick." I said, "Yeah." He said, "They sent another teacher." I said, "Yes, they did." He said, "When I'm sick, they don't send another little boy." I looked at that precious little face and I thought, "Oh, honey, the times you'll wish you could send someone else to do it for you, you know." And they wouldn't send in another sick candidate for Al-Anon to recover for me. No one could work the program for me. Nobody could get well for me. My group said, "We don't hear the answer until we've asked the question." And I had all the answers. I'm really glad you didn't know me then. My sponsor gently began to say that I might need to unlearn some things, you know. She said, "We can't teach someone who knows everything." Why would she say that to me? But she did. And she said, "Would you give up some of your old ideas?" Adolescents are independent. I'll do it myself. And that's a necessary phase of our growth. But happily mature adults are interdependent. I am not talking about a sick, clinging neediness, okay? I'm talking about the fact that I don't see visions or hear voices. I am not being sarcastic. I think probably there are people who do, but I don't, and God works in my life through people. And so I have to listen to you when I need help. He works through people I don't even like, and I don't want to listen to them, and I think it's terribly unfair of him to do that. But I have learned to ask for help. If you could see my long-distance charges, you would know that I have learned. If I can't make it through the night in Texas, California is still awake. And if they're asleep, there's Hawaii. You told me that I not only had a right to, but a responsibility for taking care of myself emotionally. I learned that some pain can be avoided. I didn't know that. I thought I had to die on every cross. And my sponsor would say things about being good to myself, and I said, you don't mean me first. She said, "No, I mean my turn." Most of the time today, when I think it is my turn, I can say, "I think it's my turn," most of the time. And if you don't hear anything else I say tonight, I hope you'll hear this next statement. And she said, "You don't have to like any situation, but it is imperative that you like yourself in it." that got me through a very painful divorce in 1980. I do not regret one word I said or one action I took. Boy, that feels good. I would wish that for you. And so you said stick with the winners, and I certainly did. And I began to learn some spiritual laws that are far more exacting and difficult to follow than the man-made rules I had been keeping so well. The story is told of a little boy who kept falling out of bed. They took him to a counselor who said to him, why do you think you keep falling out of bed? And he said, I go to sleep too close to where I got in. Well, I didn't want to go to sleep in the program too close to where I got into it. And so I began to seek out answers and people and learn from their wisdom. Spiritual laws, the worst immorality is judgment. And I pray about it a whole lot. But I think it is the worst of the immoralities. One thing that has helped me give up being quite so judgmental is that very often God gives me that same situation to handle. As soon as I say, well, you would never catch me, you will. And sooner rather than later. Or if I say, well, I would never, I do. And I've reached the point now where I try to hear myself before I say it, you know? So that I can say, wait, I didn't mean it. I don't want to handle that. You know, please, please, I don't want to handle that. I still don't release easily and quickly. Sometimes I have to release with anger before I can with love. And sometimes I have to withdraw emotionally for a while before I can let go. And everything I've ever released in my life has claw marks all over it, but I do better than I used to do. And I quit translating. Did you ever translate, you know, honey, what your daddy meant was, yes, you did that. I decided they could slug it out toe-to-toe the best they could. My kids were in Alateen for 10 years each. They came in when we had a preteen group. They stayed in Alateen until my daughter said, I don't guess we can pass the physical anymore. My daughter did a great deal of speaking for Alateen. In West Texas, we had a post-teen group from 18 to 26, and my son was in that for a very long time. I could tell you how Charles had damaged our children, and I did if you slowed down long enough. But my group made me look at how I had damaged them, and I thought I couldn't stand it. You know, I would have died for them in a New York minute as you would your child. Almost exclusively, until we got to you, and they were 9 and 10 when we got to you. But worse than that, when they would turn to this woman to whom they should have been able to turn for the truth under any circumstances, I would say things like, why no, honey, you didn't hear that last night. You had a bad dream. Why no, there's nothing wrong. Why do you think there's something wrong? And I submit to you tonight that children reared like that grow up doubting their sanity, doubting their judgment, doubting their senses. I would undo all that if I could. I cannot. I was more than my mistakes even then, and so were you. I accept her now. I will eventually learn to love her. I wish I had time to tell you the stories of having all of us in the program. I just will say there's a special place in heaven, or when I'm in California, I say an especially beneficial karma for all Alateen sponsors. God bless you, bless you, bless you. You help, yes, yes. You helped undo some of the god-awful damage that we did them. You told me I could respond rather than react. I didn't know that. I let other people decide how I felt. My sponsor said, you know, you're really in emotional slavery. And I denied it, but I realized that it's as if I woke up every morning and said to Charles, good morning, how do I feel today? Because it was entirely up to him. Let me say quickly, he didn't ask for that. It's as if I handed my self-worth to him on a platter and said, what I think of me will depend on you. I'm having to decide what to leave out as I go. I will tell you that I didn't learn the program all at once. Of course I didn't. I learned it slowly and painfully through blood, sweat, and tears, 124 hours at a time, and I still don't have it all. There are days when I think, what program? God who? I have to talk about my children because this is family groups. They're fine today, I think, thank you, and I mean thank you. They both have been married and divorced. Used to, I had several hours at DFW when I flew somewhere. I'm lucky today to sprint from one gate to another. But when I had several hours, we date the people we meet, and he meets models. So he would come out and spend 2 or 3 hours with me with one of these gorgeous young things on his arm. They all weighed 36 pounds and had legs up to their armpits. I told him if I wanted to feel dowdy, I could stay home and iron, you know, I didn't have to do. He wasn't mad at anybody. He didn't blame anybody, nor should he. But he has severe and incapacitating depression, and if you have impaired judgment by virtue of having it, you don't know you have it. I thought it would kill me, but you don't die of that. Pain like that gets to a live-withable level, you know? I still take a day off every few weeks and cuss and kick and cry. Did I say they've each been married and divorced? I said that. My daughter was a journalist for 20 years, and she too did, we're achievers, what can I tell you? We do things well. That's what got us strokes, and that's what I taught them. And she too had awards, and she did extremely good work and made an immense amount of money, and she was political editor for the St. Petersburg Times and then was their national correspondent in Washington. And in 1997, she called me and said, "Mother, I have resigned my job. I'm going to ministerial school and be a unity minister." I said all the right things. You'd be proud of me. But when I hung up, I called my sponsor and I cried and screamed and yelled and babbled and bubbled and just. And when I slowed down enough, she said, "Who reared that kid?" She said, who would bring up a young woman to find the God of her understanding and help other people? I can't imagine who'd rear a kid like that. I said, "Oh, but she's giving up so much." Another is, "Heal in me what needs to be healed, reveal to me what needs to be revealed." See, I can memorize them if they rhyme. And she's fine. She really is. They had all the problems that adult children of alcoholics have, but they've always known where to go for help. Charles and I lost our marriage for a variety of reasons it would not be appropriate for me to talk about into a microphone. I will tell you there were disorders other than alcoholism, and he chose not to get help for those. Marriages made in sickness do not always survive health, okay? And we had married for the wrong reasons and we had nothing to go back to. Because people who love us ask, "No, he did not leave me for another woman. And no, I did not throw him out for another man. And no, he did not resume drinking." He would have had 24 years continuous sobriety in July of 1988, but he died in April of that year. Lung cancer, odd cell carcinoma, still smoking 4 packs a day. I was astonished at the level of my grief. We'd been apart for 8 years, and it was just agonizing. And I turned to you as I have at any other difficult time of my life. Our recovery had taken us down different roads, you know, and in different directions. Something toxic happened when we tried to relate to each other that didn't happen when we related to other people. And it took all my recovery to realize that I too would go to any lengths to get well, that we could not gain any further recovery within the framework of a marriage that was sick beyond healing, that had been damaged beyond repair. I have always thought it was a lot like an amputation. It might be necessary for survival, but the pain is very real, and there's phantom pain. You know what that is, where the relationship used to be. I've never regretted the divorce, I have regretted the necessity for it as I would have the necessity for an amputation. And for a woman of my generation, I learned I'm a whole person without a man. And the men who have been in my life since that time were there because we both wanted them to be, and not because one of us had a loose umbilical cord we were trying to plug into the other one, you know, for a life support system. Much better that way. If you love teaching, you do a lot of counseling. I thought I should get a piece of paper that said I could. So I began looking around for graduate schools, and since you had convinced me I deserved the best, I of course picked the longest, hardest one in the state of Texas, and it was at the University of Texas in Austin, and that's why I left West Texas. 3 years, 54 hours, and a thesis. I said to my children, 3 years? Do you know how old I'll be in 3 years if I go get a master's degree? And my son said, how old will you be in 3 years if you don't? So I pulled up roots and I left my comfort zone and sold my house. And you would have laughed to see me in graduate school. I kept wanting to teach the class. I kept wanting to say, honey, what the professor meant was, you know. I also wanted to correct their grammar, but I did know better than that. In 1985, I did get the degree in counseling psychology, the master's degree. And I worked part-time at Austin Community College for several years. But I was self-supporting through my own contributions, and the rent was coming due very regularly. So I decided I needed a full-time job, and that's when I went to work at the little country school I mentioned. I stayed at Austin Community College to teach one class a week. It was a class in human sexuality. It had to be taught by a counselor. And I told them very truthfully that I had an aunt who was the matriarch of the family. And I could, I heard her dozens of times saying to my mother, when it's time to tell Blanche Marie the facts of life, let me do it, you'll make it sound entirely too exciting. It was great fun teaching a sex class. Now don't get smart, it was all lecture, no lab. And one thing about it, unlike the kids in my English classes, these students never once said, what are we learning this for? We'll never use this. Never once. Change is hard for me. I'm sure it's not for you, but it is for me. And I've got to close by telling you of the changes I made. I'll wind this down. I said, I'm so glad. What do you do? Reached over and got my tablet. Now, very laboriously, tongue between the teeth, he wrote H-S-I-T. He said, I wrote that down. I said, uh-huh. Then what? Well, I showed it to them. I said, and what happened? Well, they couldn't read it. Well, now, I was a fire horse hearing the bell. You don't wave a misspelled word in front of an English teacher. And I said, well, darling, you didn't spell it right. Here, let me show you. This is how you... I did. I was crossing the T before I thought, oops. I don't think this is in my job specifications. Nowhere do I think it said, teach obscenities to six-year-olds. I don't think it said that either. But if he's needed the word since, he knows how to spell it. I always hoped that when he went home that day, nobody said, what did you learn in school today? My point is, changing from teaching to counseling was a big change. They are not the same thing. I made some other changes. To my surprise, I was quite happy living alone. I didn't know I would be. I had never lived alone, and it was a new experience. And so it was in November of 91, I was getting ready to go talk in Tulsa. We talked on the phone every night. He didn't live in Austin, and I did. Now, every now and then, I step outside my program just for a few minutes to do a little managing and controlling. Somebody has to, and I am so good at it. So I said to him, 5 weeks from today will be your 25th AA birthday. What would you like to do? Let's do something special. He said, I think I'd like to get married. Well, it wasn't his turn in the first place. And before I could point that out, he said, I've talked to my AA sponsor, my three children, my lawyer, and my accountant. They all think it's a good idea. Is that romantic or what? Could you have turned down a proposal like that? I said, well, let me talk to some people. I came back Monday and said, okay, let's go for it. Bob was a very ardent Episcopalian, and he had a church and a minister, and I did not. And he said he wouldn't feel married if he didn't marry in his church. Fine with me. So we had the mandatory premarital counseling. It was a small neighborhood church, and after all the things that needed to be said were said, I said to the minister, how many people will your church hold? And he said, 122 Episcopalians or 144 Baptists. Having grown up Baptist, I of course walked right into it. And I said, why? And he said, Baptists are narrower. Can you believe that? That was in December. We bought a house in Salado in February. Salado is not really a retirement center, but there are some people well along in years who live there. I've been told the average bra size is 38 long. I'm glad you thought that was funny. I think that's funny. In March, Bob became ill, and in June, we were told he would not recover. If God had said to me, you can have this really neat guy in your life for a total of 6 years, I would have said, I'll take it. I wouldn't have missed it for anything. I wish you had been at the funeral. There was the bank president and the tattooed bikers, you know, the Rotary Club president and the kids who worked for Bob. Everywhere I've talked since his death, I have urged the people listening to me, please say hello. You know I'm not talking about a casual greeting, don't you? I mean, be the first one to reach out, to risk rejection, the first one to say I love you. I don't know what would have happened if I had never said hello to this man. I said, what do you do while you're in the hallway? While you're waiting to know God's will. Interesting answers. One person said, I tend to homestead. I snuggle down and I get comfortable, and when the door does open, I resent the draft. She said. Another one said, I lose patience and I try to break into the locks. She said, I know that's like taking the bud of a flower. I believe that while we're in the hallway, we're being prepared for whatever gift God has for us next. And I think I've been there a long time now. I have got to shut up. You were a great audience. I close, as always, with an Al-Anon promise. It's in our literature, so you may not have... No, I won't say that. I will not say that. I started to say, so you may not be familiar with it. I can't convince people we have more than two books, but we do. This is what it says. It says, today, this very moment is all you're sure of. And that flashing instant has gone to join the past even before you are aware of it. With this dizzy spin of time, the only safe way to make each moment count is to make Al-Anon responses habitual. You can't go wrong following Al-Anon's teachings. With these teachings, there is no regret for yesterday, there's guidance for today, and there's hope for tomorrow. So that's the promise with which I leave you on this unduly warm February night in Houston, Texas. We have been promised that we will have no regret for yesterday, and guidance for today, and best of all, hope for tomorrow.